Welcome to the Flabby Bottom Flying Club Studios and the EAA Chapter 84 podcast. I'm your host, David Weber. We have a great podcast for you this month as I bring you an interview with chapter member Tracy Hatch. As many of you know, Tracy has been building a plans/scratch-built aircraft that started off as a Banty ultralight, but in true Tracy Hatch fashion, he has re-engineered many aspects of the aircraft into something that no longer meets the ultralight category, but instead is the much more capable experimental category aircraft. Tracy and I talk about the engineering efforts he undertook to ensure the aircraft would be safe and perform up to his high expectations. Tracy goes into detail on everything from engine mounts to fabric covering and final paint. Of course, I get Tracy to tell us a little bit about his childhood in Minnesota and how an uncle had a big influence on his aviation addiction. Tracy also lets the chapter in on a little secret about what has been going on in his personal life and why we haven't seen much of him lately. I think you'll find it very inspiring. Once again, we conclude the podcast as I bring you the latest Chapter 84 news, including updates on meetings and events. Please, if you're enjoying these podcasts, I would encourage you to subscribe. Doing so helps keep this podcast going, but more importantly, it will help you know when a new podcast is available. We'll be right back after a quick break. Welcome to the Flabby Bottom Flying Club Studios, and this evening it's an honor to welcome an old friend of mine who I've known for several years now. Actually, we share a hangar down at Harvey Field together, Tracy Hatch. Welcome to the studios, Tracy.
Hey, Dave.
How you doing? Hey, how are you doing
today?
Good
to see you.
Nice to see you. It's been a while. It's been a long while. Well, with the infamous virus that went around, and I know you've had a few medical problems. We'll get into that later, but let's just jump back into your childhood a little bit. Why don't you tell our audience where you grew up and kind of what it was like growing up?
I was born on the border of Minnesota and Canada, and my parents moved to a town called Sedan in northern Minnesota. We lived there just a few years, but went to Tower, and they're kind of a paired pair of towns. So Tower is on Lake Vermilion. It's like the third, fourth biggest lake in Minnesota, and it borders the Boundary Water Canoe Area, which is wilderness, and lots of people go there canoeing, basically.
Did you do a lot of that growing up?
Well, we went. We'd take the boat loaded full of camping gear and go on a portage, and a little ATV would drag you across this 1 mile.
A lot of fishing
mile.
And hunting when you were a kid.
Yeah, so it was very much a outdoorsy kind of place. The area was known for it was known for forestry at first, but then really that's where iron mining really came from. So there's all these taconite mines, and it's called the Iron Range from about halfway up the state of Minnesota to basically the Boundary Water. So they produce taconite, and
was your dad involved in this?
No. My dad was a teacher at the high school and a librarian, and he was the driver's ed guy. And
oh, great.
And mom was a nurse.
I bet he had a lot of great stories.
Yeah, so mom was a nurse. So she lived in, or she worked in Ely, which is like 20 miles away. So, there was always a kind of odd situation where mom had to commute.
She worked odd hours.
Well, she worked, early, but 20 miles in the middle of winter, it's 40 below.
Gosh.
So I remember we would go have to go dig the car out of the ditch, you know.
Well, it's Minnesota.
Right. I really experienced the Arctic in the continental United States.
Now, do you have any brothers or sisters?
Yeah, so I have one sister.
Younger?
She's a year older than me.
Okay.
And she's ended up in Minnesota also. What else? We lived in this little town, it was population about 700. And so, you know, I had to walk to school 4 blocks uphill both ways when it was minus 40 below. And,
oh, my gosh. Yeah, of course.
So, but yeah, my dad would drive, and the vehicle wouldn't even get warmed up by the time he got there.
Oh, well, it's 40 below.
Right. So eventually, I remember the engine would build up condensation. So at some point he took a torch and was heating up the oil pan, pulled the plug, and about a quart of water comes out of it, which is a block of ice. Minnesota was quite a harsh place. And that's why I live in Washington. Yeah, I love Washington.
How long did you live in Minnesota?
So I grew up, I guess you could say in the 70s. If I was born in 63, would have been, 10 at 73. You know, I remember 1976, where there'd be like a Nova with the flag emblem stickers, right? And then by 79, that car'd be all rusted out because they salted the road so much there.
So did you end up graduating high school in that same town?
So graduated from Tower.
Okay.
Actually Tower Sound. Then went straight down to Minneapolis and I guess I graduated high school in 81, and then I graduated from the University of Minnesota in 85 or 86.
With a degree in mechanical engineering.
Mechanical engineering. And tie-in to aviation is our wing of the building was right next to the aerospace. That actually was.
So had you done any aviation things up to this point?
Not personally. Well, let me get back to that. But the wing of it wasn't really aerospace. It was aeronautical engineering.
Okay.
But anyway, I recall they had a complete wooden framed biplane, uncovered, and those guys would sit and analyze structures, analyze that plane. And I didn't really know what it was all about. I was just like, oh, that's a pretty cool thing, you know, they had in a room.
Did you have any idea what kind of an airplane it was? Or was
it was just this big wooden structure.
Big wooden
structure. Kind of like what I built.
And they would sit there and analyze.
Yeah, they'd use it as a...
Would they do any destructive testing on it?
I think they used it as a talking point. Yeah. You know,
this is
look
a
at this structure, yeah. and it all applies to, you know, aluminum, I suppose.
But that piqued your interest in the aviation side.
Yeah.
But not enough to get a degree in aeronautics.
I didn't know. And I kind of discovered that late in my time. You know, you're there like four or five years.
Right.
But going back, Tower was on a lake called Lake Vermilion. Our house was on the road that went to the lake, and the lake had a campground called Hoodoo Point. And so we had tourists coming by all the time. So as a little kid, it was a campground. It was a recreational area. So people would drive up from Chicago with their big trucks and their nice boats, and from Minneapolis, and they'd come, you know, the lake. You know, we were about 200 miles from Minneapolis, straight north. So it was a tourist area as I grew up, and I remember selling worms to the fishermen in the spring and that kind of thing, and night crawlers. But right next to the campground was a little airport, and so there'd be, you know, it was a grass strip, I think, and like they'd have four or five biplanes. And I remember my dad wasn't really friends with those people because they were wild and crazy people.
They were wild.
And they crashed, you know, occasionally.
Those insane, crazy people and fly airplanes, yes.
And then, meanwhile, my dad and his brother's name's Gary, and my dad's Robert. So these guys, got into model airplanes when they were little kids.
Okay.
So growing up, we'd go visit my Uncle Gary, and he had three kids. And
this is still in the Midwest?
Yeah, this is Minnesota. It was actually Wilmer, Minnesota. But he was really into the airplanes, the model airplanes.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point, so I got a little exposure with that. So I kind of got into model airplanes. And my dad kind of encouraged me. I built a lot of models when, like...
Now, were these flyable models?
Or yeah. Okay. Model air...
So like control line?
What do you
line?
Call those? Control... They go in a circle?
Yeah, the okay, control line those. Type. The two-string control lines?
Right. And I remember building, just an RC plane and flying it and off the airport and then losing it. It flew out into the campground and we had to go chase it, of course. And it came down in the tree right next to some Kaffirs and they were screaming. And then we collected the wreckage and got out of there as quickly as we could. So I had...
Back when they didn't call the police
right,
on you,
right? I had a few successful flights, but most of them augured in, So
Do you remember what that model was?
No. I mean, it was just generic, Yeah. Probably had like a 0.21.
Yeah, like
a 0.35 or something like that,
Oh, okay. So something that big, yeah.
Yeah. And so that was that. At some point, my parents both came from North Dakota, and so they have wheat farms, my family.
Right.
So I remember riding in, and it must have been like a Citabria, but I'd get a ride with my uncle from central Minnesota to North Dakota. Their farms were basically within a mile of the border of Canada.
So your uncle had his pilot's license, and he would give you these rides.
So I remember getting to fly up there with him, and
in a Citabria.
Yeah, or what I remember was it had windows on the sides.
Okay.
Down low, high wing,
right?
Conventional thing. I don't know why I remember Citabria. That's the acrobatic version of Champ.
Right.
Yeah. Does that make sense that it would have been side by side?
Citabrias are usually tandem.
It could have been Piper.
A Chief is side by side.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I don't remember specifically. I bet I was like 12 or something like that.
But you remember it was like a tube and fabric type of airplane.
Right.
And did he ever let you fly, take the stick and
I think I was pretty young. but he would fly in and we'd go up there and help with harvest every year. That's when need the most people.
Yeah.
So Gary's landing on this, every mile in the farm areas, there's this little dirt road, mm-hmm. a little bit of grass, and there's the fields right there. Well, Gary'd come in and he'd fly over, wave his wings, and I'm driving a little truck to deal with the combine dumping grain. He'd flap his wings and then we'd all stop, right? Because it was a big scene.
Right.
And so he'd land on this little gravel road, jump out like this classic aviator guy, But we always had to haul him around. We had to take him there. The weather's going to change. Gary's got to go, So he was kind of a burden, but he was just larger than life,
I always go back to that scene where in The Great Waldo Pepper.
Right. It was just like that.
Paul Newman hops out and he's got that big smile coming down.
So it was always a celebration for me to see Gary because there's always a chance I could go flying.
But you had that desire at that time.
Oh, well, yeah, it was, I suppose it was, my idea of full size, of building a full size airplane was, I remember there was a RC modeler that had a Anderson Kingfisher, but it was like a quarter scale model. And I remember thinking, you know, I could scale this up four times and I would have a full size one, you know? And then it turns out it worked the other way around.
The
model was a derivative of the full size one. So I didn't figure that out. So I think, I mean, all of that is formative, you know, little kid playing radio control models. Then, you know, I guess, you know, I live by the airport and always sort of wondering about it. But, you know, they had a little fence around it. And
yeah.
You kind of had to know somebody or whatever.
So you got out of college and then...
So then I moved south, went to Minneapolis and, you know...
Got a job.
Very, very poor college student. So never thought about it. And then, I don't know what happened. I guess... I moved out to Seattle in 87, and
was there a job out here waiting for you?
No, it was one of those. I had a girlfriend named Michelle, and her mom lived here, and so I was gonna move out here, and then within six months or whatever, she was gonna.
Yeah.
Well, everything kind of fell apart,
right?
So I'm here, right? And so I got this job, and.
You got a job where?
Oh.
Was it doing?
I guess I'm confused. I've jumped forward now.
Yeah.
Okay, so I graduated from college. I moved out here. I took temporary jobs. You know, it was like the Seattle buses. They had air compressors for the brakes, and the little brackets would crack. So for a week, I remember installing reinforced brackets to hold the air compressors so the air compressor wouldn't fall off the bus, you know, things like that.
Wow.
So,
real basic engineering.
Yeah, just BS temp jobs, you know, mechanic type stuff. Well, anyway, I fell into this company that basically takes engines, diesel engines, and builds generator sets with them. So you take an engine and an electrical generator and you bolt them together and maybe make an enclosure and a bunch of accessories so you can make electricity. And that was called Chem Equipment. I think I worked there for about 7 years. And again, at that point, that would have been about 87, and somewhere about 1990, I got into remote control boats.
Oh, okay.
Okay. So.
Still no aviation, no private pilots.
None of that just in the picture at all.
You had the tickle, but not enough to jump in yet.
Yeah. And so I built this boat, and it had like a 0.9 Pico Rossi, you know, 6 horsepower at 22,000 RPM.
Yeah.
Had some incidents with that. I think I got 15 or 30 stitches in my leg.
Oh, my gosh.
Never stand in the water when you're running a remote control boat. Okay. And then, I remember I had built one of these little airboats. You know, top-mounted model airplane engine propeller on a little catamaran kind of hull. Got a bunch of stitches and a couple fingers on that one, you know, adjusting the carburetor.
Didn't learn your lesson.
No.
Huh?
I've been somewhat accident prone. Whenever you get in a hurry, bad things happen.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
So, anyway, so I worked for that company for a while. It got acquired and then it moved to Auburn and kind of got merged in. And within a few years,
did you move with them to Auburn?
No. Oh. See when I first moved here, I lived at the University of Washington in a sort of a rooming house, just like I'd been living in Minneapolis and mm-hmm. University Avenue right there, right? See, it's amazing how it's set up, very similar to Minneapolis's, it's a place called Dinky Town, but it's the same setup as the Ave here.
Okay.
So I moved to where I knew, found, probably within a few months, found a little apartment in Ballard and lived there for a few years. And I suppose right around 1990-91, I bought a house in Shoreline. And I remember it was like the most expensive thing I could afford, and it was $81,000.
Wow.
it's funny. I hate to say it, I'm still there, but at least it's paid for, you know, probably $500,000 or something.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Anyway, so the thing of commuting to Auburn
just didn't work out.
It just kind of sucked. And at some point
what was the next job? Where'd you move on to?
So then next thing you know, I have to find a job. So all of a sudden headhunters are calling me. So I got a job at the Caterpillar distributor in Chicago. It's called Patton Power Systems. And it was probably 93 or 4, something like that. So I moved out there.
Moved to Chicago.
Right. Now I'm working on all these Caterpillar projects. And in the end, I didn't sell my house. I'd been renting it out, mm-hmm. you know, making
obviously,
tiny amounts.
Since you're still there today.
Right.
Yeah.
And the whole time, I just wanted to come back here. That was just temporary. I didn't know what to do. I'll take the job. But Chicago is kind of like Minnesota.
Yeah.
Kind of harsh weather.
Right.
And it seemed like all of my vacations, any time off, I just drove to Minnesota. 500 miles or something. Ugh. Yeah. And then I don't remember what happened. I guess I went on this project to Thailand. So I spent like a month in Bangkok, working most days, but it was about 3 megawatt backup generator to power up the whole power plant facility, which was probably about 250 megawatts. Remember, it was a combined cycle gas turbine setup, and it was fed with like a 1 foot diameter pipe.
Wow.
Of natural gas.
So you're still doing generator stuff at this time.
So I'm over there and I worked and you know.
How do you end up back in Seattle then?
Oh, okay. So that would have been spring of 97, and I concluded it's time to go home. There's too many strings forming around me in Chicago, and I'll never get out of here. It was a great job. They loved me, and they wouldn't let me leave, basically. Okay. So it was whining and dining and all of that. But I kind of wanted to come back to Seattle. So I...
Did you start looking for a job, or did they...
No.
People just start...
No. I remember, I think I had like, you know, $15,000 saved up. Anyway, so I had all kinds of stuff, you know, because, of course, I'm kind of a hoarder. And, you know, when I went to Chicago, I drove a Ryder truck and towed my car. And it was a giant packed thing. And the company had rented this for me specifically because it had a Caterpillar diesel engine in it. So...
Okay.
Went across the country at,
whatever,
you know, 70 miles an hour with all this stuff. Well, coming back here, I somehow acquired a pontoon boat because I wanted to have a boat when I got back here. This doesn't make any sense. It was a good deal.
You're still single? It doesn't make sense?
Well,
perfect.
Okay, but a pontoon boat in Seattle doesn't make any sense. So anyway, I had to buy a little double axle trailer and get this boat on this trailer. And it was my idea of a moving thing. So it was like the Beverly Hillbillies, where I've got all this furniture and all my stuff loaded above and below the trailer and or the boat on this flatbed trailer. And I remember coming back, you know, at 45 miles an hour. This, because my Toyota Tacoma is small compared to this big thing, you know. It was a 20-foot pontoon boat. I remember I could barely make 40 miles an hour coming up over the pass. And I remember stopping in Moses Lake at the campground. There's a campground on a lake there or something.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm sitting there in my rocking chair at the campsite because, you know,
just I've got all my
furniture and stuff. But yeah, I had to chill out for a few days. So anyway, I got back here, and again, some of those temporary jobs, you know, the mechanic things or whatever. But somehow I fell in. I found out that the guy who had been like the engineering manager or the director or whatever was leaving this company. And it turned out a handful of people I used to work with at the previous companies now work at this other generator manufacturing company. That was Alaska Diesel Electric. And mm-hmm. So I walked in there and I had an interview with Harold. Harold was the owner. Took me to a Chinese restaurant. We had a two-hour interview, about an hour worth of that interview, he was taking a nap, and I'm just patiently waiting for him to wake up and ask me some more questions.
That's hilarious.
Yeah, so I got good recommendations from a bunch of people that were already working there. So I was in. Well, there was a guy there that was kind of a character. I don't know if you remember a guy named Christian Holtz. Mm. Anyway, I'm not staying in touch with lots of people. But he's part of Angel Flight.
Ah, okay.
He worked there. Him and another guy, I don't remember his name, it was Andy. Well, they had an ultralight up at, it was a Challenger up at Arlington. And so I followed him up there. And I should mention, that summer, I was in Thailand for a month, came back, and one of the guys in the shop decides he's going to build one of those little single-seat helicopters.
Oh, you're kidding.
Right. And so I go out to this place, and he's got like a Fiero seat hanging on a bungee cord in his living room that he's going to build this helicopter around. Well, he made me aware of Oshkosh. So we went to Oshkosh.
And you had never heard of Oshkosh before?
Nope, didn't know about it, right? Okay. So, you know, we were in Chicago, and we went up there, you know, it was couple hour drive or whatever, right. And camped, and I'm like, oh my god, gotta do this,
right?
So I pretty much quit and said, I'm moving back to Seattle. I can't do this here in the city in Chicago. So I moved back to Seattle, and that was my big plan for my life. I'm gonna build an airplane. And at that point, it could have been that scaled up quarter scale Anderson Kingfisher that's on the cover of RC Modeler magazine.
Stuck in the back of your brain, right?
So anyway, got back here and you know, bumped into Christian. Next thing you know, I'm part of the EA Chapter 26 Ultralights at Arlington. And about the first month that I got that job, that would have been December of 97. I ordered a couple set of plans. I ordered the Banty because it seems so simple.
Right.
$25, oh, whatever. You get like 50 pages.
And it's considered a true ultralight.
Yeah, it was an ultralight. And the guy who designed it was an airline pilot from down by Chehalis somewhere. So I did go to a couple fly-ins with Christian, and it was an amazing experience. It's just one guy, a lot of family. let's say hundreds of people come to his little farm, and he's got this little strip kind of cut out of the woods, you know. And I got to see the original, right? Great, that's cool. I'm like, I don't really like how that axle assembly is. Okay,
so you start picking I'm gonna it have apart.
To change that. And it doesn't seem as enclosed. So add a little something there, a little turtle deck part, you know. So next thing you know, I'm going, you know.
But you hadn't made the choice that you're going to build this plane yet.
No.
You're just deciphering in your mind what changes you would make if you did.
And I got those, it was like a handbook of experimental aircraft, all the choices and all right. that. And at this point, I didn't have a pilot's license, you know, nothing. Well, I think within that, it happened really fast. I remember.
What happened really fast? Like
I'm going to build an airplane. So I'm part of this chapter. I'm seeing, you know, Christian. I took ultralight training, you know, which doesn't amount to a whole lot.
Right.
But the moment you're done, you need to either buy something or build something. Okay. You can't rent something.
So at this point, you've got ultralight training, but, right. but you don't have a pilot's right. license.
So I've soloed, and they cut the back of your shirt off. That right. was quite the memorable experience.
Do you remember what you soloed in?
It was a 2-seat Challenger.
Okay.
And that was at Arlington. And then all of a sudden, now what? Right? Anyway, so I remember ordering a bunch of spruce from Aircraft Spruce. My airplane started out as more or less a 16-foot 4x4 package.
But you knew you were going to build the Banty at this point.
I think at that point I'd settled on that.
And what year was this?
That would have been 97.
Okay.
So, which is 25 years ago.
Time flies.
Oh, my God.
All right, so let's talk a little bit more about the Banty, which is the airplane that you decided to build. You told us that you first saw it out in, where was it again?
But Chehalis.
Chehalis there. And you got to meet the designer.
Right.
Okay. And so why were you drawn to this particular airplane?
I think it was because it was an all-wood design, and they said it didn't require any welding, and I'd built a lot of wooden airplane models.
Okay.
And I still have a small collection in the back room at home.
Yeah. And so that just appealed to your nature, right?
Right.
And then it's a single seat.
Right.
So one you were seat. Still thinking ultralight.
Ultralight.
You weren't thinking pilot license at this
right.
point.
Right.
Okay.
So then I regret. I'm going to just throw in there for a moment. About a year and a half ago, I was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. And so I spent last summer doing chemo, when they try to kill you every 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in January this year, I had that surgery, and they cut that out, and most of my pancreas and my spleen. And within a month or so, I managed to go back to work. I missed 9 months of work. Company was awesome, you know. I can't say enough about that. But so I'm afraid I'm not as sharp as I used to be. But
okay.
I think I'm getting better every day, every month, and really looking forward to going flying again. But this summer has really been a summer of recovery.
Yeah, it's been a challenge.
And it seems the better I feel, the more I work. And I'm working more than I should again.
I've tried to keep this somewhat on the lowdown with the chapter.
Of what? What do you mean?
Of your medical condition, of what was going on. I didn't know how much you wanted to share. But obviously now it's out there.
Yeah.
So let's kind of jump into that maybe a little bit.
Okay. So I was given not even a 10% chance, right? And so a lot of your perspective changes when you realize your end date is coming.
Mm-hmm.
And by the fall, I was responding very well. The little tumor and whatever is shrinking and shrinking, and to the point where they said, we think we can take care of it. You know, it had wrapped around some arteries or something. You know, it was bad.
So they decided to go in and surgically remove
it. Yeah. So first thing was shrink it as much as they could, and then cut away everything that was of risk. It did take me about a month just to recover from that surgery. So that was January. And I think I went back to work the end of January, and it was, you know, I could barely work for 5 hours a day, and I had a lot of...
Well, you had a lot of responsibilities at this company, too. Well, you were...
They said, go take care of it, get better, we got you covered. Well,
mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot of things I'm cleaning up still, but we're a little company. We try to do a lot more than we probably should. We compete. We're a company of 50, 60 people, and we compete with people like Onan and Caterpillar and Kohler, and we have a worldwide footprint.
Yeah.
And
But mostly marine.
Yes, strictly marine. Not strictly. I mean, a small percentage of land-based generators, but mostly diesel generators for yachts and commercial boats, tugboats, ferry boats, that kind of thing. So it's electrical generators and propulsion engines.
But now you're back almost full time?
Yeah, so...
It's been well over a year, right?
Well, I've been back, I guess, 9 months.
Okay.
And trying to not work 8 hours a day, but it seems like the last month or so, I'm not getting out of there until 6:30. There's just so much to do, and I'm so motivated to make up for being gone.
Yeah.
And we are on the verge of releasing a brand new product range that's going to change the world.
Of course.
that basically I got it started and then had to let it go for that period.
But how has this impacted your progress on the Banty? I mean,
okay.
You know, getting back to that.
I
know when you first told me about the diagnose, you were really close to flying that plane. It had its...
The plane was...
Certificate?
Was certified in...
You had your inspection, you had your...
Yeah, I think the plane was certified in 15 or 18 or something. Yeah.
And you had decided to make a couple modifications to it before that, before you flew it, because you weren't happy with the control system. The control was...
The stick hit. Yeah. As soon as, you know, it was all done, the stick hit. Yeah. So I had to reconfigure the stick to give myself a little more room.
But made more than that on that airplane.
Yeah, so I really wanted this thing to look like some 1920s, you know, one seat, you know, little... like a little cub or something like that. Yeah. Okay. So
he came up with a pretty unique name for it. You don't call it a banty.
Yeah, it's I was going to correct you on that. It's not a banty. It's a snail hawk. So it needed to be a hawk, but it's a real slow hawk. I think Cruz is going to be about 55. You know,
let's kind of get into why you call it a snail hawk, because it's not really a banty. You've made some significant changes to the original banty design. For one thing, the landing gear.
The landing gear is now, a little bit taller. It's quite a bit wider.
It's not just an axle riding on the fuselage.
Right. It's on the tires legs
as a suspension.
Yeah.
You actually have a suspension.
There's ATV tires and there's a bungee cord wrapped axle. So it is a rigid axle design.
But this wasn't something that you just stuck your finger up in the air and said, this looks good. You did some engineering behind this.
I probably spent years collecting airplane design books, landing gear design. Mm-hmm. It really was kind of a second kind of college education kind of thing.
Almost like a senior project.
Yeah. Way back when I thought, I want to go work for Boeing. Well, there's some pluses and minuses of Boeing, and I really am settled in where I work, and very well could retire from there.
But the work that you did on the changes of the band, to make it the snail hawk is amazing.
Yeah, so
I mean, you did things like
the biggest thing was the landing gear was taller.
Right.
I didn't like the idea of the Rotax 277. You couldn't buy a new one anymore.
Okay.
And so
you ended up with a Hearth.
The Hearth came from Eastside Engines. The guy, I can't remember now. I'm sorry.
It's all right.
Back to the memory thing. But guy up at Arlington for the Ultralight Park, he was like the FBO. So found out about Hearths. Hearths are very not as high performance, you could say.
Okay.
They seem to have pretty good durability in a sense. And so going to a bigger engine, this is a 40 horsepower two cylinder now.
Okay.
And it's got one carburetor. Well, if it had two carburetors, it would be a 55 horse. They have better porting on the cylinders and so forth. So there's always the, I could have more power, right? More power. So anyway, I had to work out the new CG, weight and balance, that kind of thing. Ended up making a tubular structure engine mount. Had some contact with people at Kenmore Air Harbor, because Kenmore is right next to. I live in Shoreline, so had a person I knew there, and so learned about how land planes, their engine mounts will crack because seaplane landings are kind of harsh.
Right.
So added a couple extra structure. Went through the whole learning about tubular structures. Had a friend of mine, I remember buying a 4x8 sheet of 3/8 steel plate as a base of a jig to hold this tubular structure together. And a friend of mine welded it all up, and then another guy said, I think you should have some gussets here and there. So there's some little gussets on critical spots. And I had another friend who, very old guy, I think he's dead now, but he reviewed all my engineering design changes. And I remember my weights going up. This was basically a 500-pound gross, and now it's about a 700-pound
gross. What was the original engine?
The Rotax 277,
which is
like 28 horsepower.
Yeah, 28 horsepower.
No, you don't get a lot more speed when you put 1.5 times the power in. But I like the idea of a two cylinder, and so I suppose I spent I spent 2 years ground testing and breaking it in and running it. And
But you also did something to the struts, right?
Okay. So systematically, you know, I didn't want to add a lot of weight, but there's some reinforcements on the spars. The struts, I believe, were going to be...
Was it a 25?
They were...
Because I remember we were testing that this, like, we could
sleeve. I sleeved a 7/8 and a 1 and then concluded I should just have a 1.
Right.
So I have a bunch of, you know, long 7/8 tube in the garage still. So I reinforced the struts because I wasn't comfortable. But you did the calculations. Yeah, I wasn't comfortable with any possible negative G's putting those struts in compression.
Okay.
So
it wasn't a tension scenario, it was the compression.
No, no. And then things like I wanted more tail area. I guess I must have read about having better directional stability.
Okay.
This engine, this design had a lot of washout. And I think I reduced that because I knew I was going to fly at a higher speed. But I didn't like the look of the tail. I wanted a nice round shape.
Right.
So the rudder is just slightly bigger in area. And the fin is probably a third bigger in area. Of course, bigger area, more structure.
Right.
You know, so little by little... And then I decided I wanted to make sure that this thing was going to last forever. So everything's got 2 or 3 coats of epoxy. This thing is set up for a seaplane.
And you had never done fabric before.
Right. Either.
So you had
right.
to, did you like go to a class to learn how to do this?
See, again, Arlington Air Show. Went to Oshkosh a few times. I'll never forget flying in. I'd fly into Minneapolis. And then drive across to Oshkosh overnight to get to the show. And, you know, maybe sleep at a campground or a rest area for an hour. And, you know, there's never enough time, right?
Never. So
I remember going to Sun and Fun and just flying in with nothing. And
just to go learn how to do these processes?
Well just to go to air shows.
Oh, okay.
And Sun and Fun was Florida, and, you know, it's the time of year where, it's nice to get down there. But I remember stopping at Walmart and buying a sleeping bag and, you know, a handful of camping stuff, and then somehow leaving it with somebody or something.
Oh, of course.
Yeah. But I love Sun and Fun. I'll never forget. I had a campsite just right next to the runway, and watching these like F-15s or something do evening flybys with afterburner flame shooting out, and you could feel it, you know.
That's great.
It was awesome. And of course, they'd have a little party, a little bonfire, and some wild women.
So you go to Oshkosh, and they have all the shops there?
I remember just walking endlessly for 5 days and just... My feet are covered in blisters.
Was this any cost to you? Were the shops free?
What do you mean?
These workshops at Oshkosh. Did you just walk in?
No. I bet I went through 5 fabric covering, you know, shows or workshops.
And they're just free. You just walk
in. Yeah.
And they just start teaching.
Have you been to Oshkosh? Yeah.
Have I been to Oshkosh?
There's so much there. It's just...
You get to go to Oshkosh. I go to Oshkosh and
work. No. You go to Oshkosh and it normalizes things.
Right.
You're surrounded by people just like you. Right. And that feeling stays with you about a year, and then you have to do it again.
But I remember you coming back and you first laying the fabric on your tail section, I believe, is what you started off.
Oh, okay. So
in the chapter hanger.
So a little history. That first year that I got that job, I remember ordering the plans and ordering the material and basically, not really sure, but I think, you know, I'm working in this one car garage, and at the point at which you have a fuselage, you know, it's
gets small.
All of a sudden, there's no room. Right. So now there's shelves and there's right. cranes, all this stuff. I remember that first winter. Probably it was the, February, March of 98. I remember driving up to Grizzly the day of Harold Johnson's funeral. He died. The guy who hired me died within a few months. Going up there and loading up a bandsaw and a drill press and the sander thing and a bunch of tools. And I basically got in my garage. No, I didn't. I had all these tools, realized I gotta have heat. So moved everything to the center of the garage and insulated, sheetrocked the walls, put in a gas furnace. A lot of things happened that first winter. So I get ahead of myself and then I stop and have to go back. So I built in the garage for roughly 93 to, sorry, probably 88 to 95, something like that. Mm-hmm. At some point, I bought a 20-foot travel trailer, gutted it, right. Turned that into storage for all the stuff I had to get out of the garage so I could work on the plane. And then at one point...
We turned that into your paint booth at one point.
Right. So at one point, I remember I had to... I put the fuselage, I think, in the trailer so I could work on wings. And so I'm really struggling. Somewhere around, I think it was 2000, I moved into the hangar. Would it have been 2000?
I think it was like 04. I think it was. Yeah, somewhere around there.
It was either 2000 or 2004. But anyway, remember it was
early 2000s.
We got the gas right. furnace and, right. and built a bunch of benches and
right.
tables. And so I was in there, and at some point, all of a sudden, the covering is done.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember if I covered piece by piece.
I think I remember you showing up with the tail covered, and then, or at least the rudder, and that.
I think a lot of the covering happened at the hangar,
and then you started.
And then at some point, it was okay. Gonna take the front of this trailer and cover it with fans and right. filters and it had a blower at the back and
right.
ducting through, you'd open a hangar door 3 feet.
What fabric system did you end up choosing?
It was that polyfiber.
The polyfiber stuff.
Right. And I spent $2,000 on MEK, mostly MEK. I don't know.
You had the full oxygen system.
Yeah, I bought that fresh air thing and then the HVLP thing. And I remember we had a guy in the chapter. He died. Do you remember that? We went to the funeral. And just before then, he'd so graciously volunteered to let me borrow all his stuff because he'd built his mm-hmm. plane and was done with it. And then I'm like, oh, that'd be great. And then by the time I got to that, he was gone. I don't know what became of all his stuff. But so I just said, I'm going to do this right. It's
right.
too expensive. So fresh air system was awesome. HVLP system is, it's great. I've actually used it to do some other paintings since then. But we set up that trailer in the hangar. And the back of it was a ramp. Technically, the trailer was used to move the project from Shoreline to Harvey Field. And I don't remember if I took the trailer back home or if it...
No, I think we parked it off on the side where our hangar is now. Remember how we kind of parked it off on the back side there?
Was it there for a while?
Yeah, I think it was there for a couple months.
It wasn't very long before
we put lights in it.
Oh, yeah, we had put all those lights in it. I remember that was... That was just the greatest thing.
Yeah.
We were set up for like doing a paint business or something.
Yeah, probably could have. And made no money.
But man, there was a lot of steps. I mean,
where's that trailer now? Where's that
trailer? Oh, Brian Durham.
No.
Brian Durham volunteered to let me store it at his place, and it got packed with airplane stuff. And he just moved to Texas. You know, he's a Boeing guy, and he moved to Texas. And we went up there, and it was during COVID, and we met this guy who gave him $200-$300, and I don't know.
All the airplane stuff? And
no, I think just most the trailer.
Okay.
And I don't remember how it went. We kind of split the money, you know, because he'd been storing this thing for, you know,
right,
5 years or something. So it's gone. It's gone to a good family, you know, whatever, good home.
So let's kind of
So finished covering. Again, you know, working a lot.
Right.
And I remember driving up to Harvey every day or something for 5 years.
Yeah.
I remember, like, being so tired. I had all these cushions from the travel trailer, and you know, laying underneath it. I remember falling asleep in the hangar.
Yeah.
And I lived there. I lived in...
Well, we kept beer in the refrigerator.
Yeah, so I lived there for 5 years or something. So got that done. Finally got it, you know, FAA certified in, I don't know, 2015 or 2018. Then went and got a tail wheel rating with Arnold. And that would have been probably about 18. Remember, I got it in the fall about this time. And couldn't fly after that. Then, I guess then COVID hit.
Yeah, you started really making a few changes that you really wanted to do before you made that first flight. And then COVID came.
Yeah.
And then obviously the...
But I remember I got my tail wheel rating.
I remember you getting your tail wheel. Remember we took up the 140 and kind of got you reintroduced to flying a little bit.
I don't know what happened. I remember I just was so busy at work.
Yeah.
And, you know, I travel a lot. I mean, I've been to Japan like a dozen times. I've been to Europe half a dozen times, and Florida, and just all over. So
what are the plans for the snail hawk? What are you going to start doing?
Okay, so I guess we didn't talk about getting sidetracked with the whole island thing and another boat. And,
no.
Okay, well,
we're talking aviation here.
Yeah, okay, so... I take on way too many things. Yeah. I don't know why. I just
perpetual project man.
Right.
Yeah.
So I was hoping to get a couple flights in before it's winter. I'm starting to read up on kind of a self-study to for like getting a pilot's license, even though I have it. I got a
refresh.
Yeah, I got that basic med.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I got the tail wheel rating. But I think that's, 3 years ago or something now.
Yeah, so you need to re-up that.
So, yeah, I got to do a little online classes and up on DFRs and everything. I'm not going to...
But your intent is to refresh your pilot's
license?
Yeah,
I'm not going to fly or even attempt to fly this thing until I'm confident that, you know, I'm current.
Okay.
The
engine's running good on it now?
I got the cooling issues done? I think so. I didn't even run it this year.
Okay.
So, last year.
And you're happy with all the stick movement on it?
Yeah, I think it's ready to go. I was hoping to pull it out of the hangar, get it all cleaned up, take all inspection covers off, do what amounts to an annual or
condition?
Yeah. Just try to make sure everything's perfect, you know?
Okay.
I think it's next spring now.
Okay.
We were talking a little while ago about the whole, you know, cancer. I'm a cancer survivor and will be for 5 years until they say, well, I guess it's gone. But, you know, a lot more appreciative. I don't want to do anything that I'm not enjoying myself. Maybe I have the wrong perspective, and I'll try to change that as I'm doing things that aren't, you know, so pleasant, like work or whatever. But it's time for me to start making plans for the future again, and I have been. Whereas, this time last year, the plans were wrapping up stuff, you know, getting projects completed so that, you know, kind of leaving things in order. So it's a weird time for me. And this is, I was apprehensive to talk to you because, you know, other people may hear this, but this is probably a good thing. I'm going to drive away thinking about, I've just described what's happened up to now. It's time to make a new story. And
put a cap on it.
What do you mean?
Just do what you got to do. Get it done.
Oh.
Make it a happy ending. You know, you got to have the end where the girl runs off with the guy over the hill.
Oh. Yeah, you know, I left on a big...
You got to have the pilot flying off into the sunset in his airplane that he built.
Yeah, I left off a big part of my life story, and that's Liz. You know, Liz
is a great guy.
My girlfriend. We've been together 25 years, watched her raise her daughter, who is now has a daughter. And
yeah.
There's another one coming. So I've somewhat lost Liz again to taking care of her granddaughter. So, but that's all right. You know, I think I built a plane to use up a lot of my free time because, you know, mm-hmm. she's preoccupied and I'm hoping that it will be something to challenge me and fill my free time going forward. I have big plans for the island. It's time to build a proper house instead of just a little cabin. I probably want to add on to my house. I noticed 2x4s have dropped in price a lot in the last few months. So that's a good indicator. And I'm really looking forward to, you know, feeling good, not having an unsettled stomach and insides. I would like to go flying. The last time I went with a friend of mine that had a, I can't think of it.
Doesn't matter, but you went flying.
The Columbia? What was the Columbia before it was a Columbia?
The Lancer?
Yeah.
The Legacy?
I
don't know.
One of those.
Okay.
But that
Columbia 400, then it... Didn't that become the Cessna? I don't know.
Yeah. Anyway, at 8,000...
Big glass airplane.
Yeah, at 8,000 feet, I was having some serious issues. Just couldn't handle low air pressure at the time.
Yeah.
So, one of the big things that I am looking forward to is getting back to flying and every day I think I feel better and just trying to get back to, you know, who I was, maybe at a little slower pace, working on work-life balance issues. And
but you see, aviation is a significant part of that, right? I'd love to see you out there putting around in that plane on summer evenings
we were talking about there's everything on YouTube. Yeah. I'm starting to watch airplane videos all the time. People are doing amazing things. My plane is probably prime to convert to electric someday. But I'm not convinced the batteries are there yet.
Let's get it up to Arlington.
Yeah.
this next year for a show. I think it'll be a spectacular
thing. I missed Arlington. I'm quite disappointed. You had to pre-book.
Yeah. They've like a lot of air shows have had to deal with this COVID stuff. Right. So I imagine hopefully if this trend continues, this stuff will go to the wayside and we'll get back to some normalcy with that kind of stuff.
Yeah, hopefully
people can actually walk around and look
next
at airplanes.
Summer will be really a reawakening for
aviation,
the world.
Yeah,
actually,
be nice.
It's challenging right now, you know.
So do you have any other, if you finish this, the Snail Hawk, do you have any other plans for another airplane after this? Or are you just going to enjoy the Snail Hawk for a while?
Yeah, I think what happens is you're young, you can do anything. You build an airplane, it's a long-term process, unless that's the only thing you do. By the time you're done, you're kind of in a different place. And when I built this, I knew this was going to take a long time. And I knew I'd be older and my reflexes a little slower.
Right.
And this is the perfect place. It's supposed to be super easy to fly, super slow, won't be too expensive. Just the thrill or whatever of getting up in the air. If I want to go somewhere, I guess you rent a Cessna or you book
Top
a flight.
Commercial.
Or you book a flight.
That's or there's right. a restroom on board.
Right. So... that would be, for me, a personal measure of success is to say I did this and I'm doing it and you know.
Well, I can tell you that we wish you the best, Tracy, and I can't wait to see that airplane fly, and I hope it flies soon.
Right.
Thanks for coming down, Tracy.
Thank you. Did we do an hour?
Oh yeah.
Oh man. I gotta pee again.
And now the news for November 2022. The campaign to get the lead out of avgas is becoming more urgent as the EPA held hearings on the subject this November with a final determination on how to accomplish this expected sometime in 2023. AOPA representatives were allowed to make comments during the hearing, and Senior Vice President of Government Affairs, Jim Kuhn, emphasized that the transition from 100 low lead to an unleaded alternative must be done in a way that protects aviation safety. He also pointed out that several fuels are being tested through the FAA's Pistons Aviation Fuel Initiative, as well as the work of EAGLE, Eliminate Aviation Gasoline Lead Emission, a coalition of industry, government, and aviation stakeholders with a shared goal of removing lead from aviation fuel by 2030. Some critics urge the EPA to ban 100 low lead immediately, following the example of County of Santa Clara, California, which banned the sale of 100 low lead in January of 2022 from its two airports. Officials at AOPA have expressed concern about rushing to ban 100 low lead, as an outright ban could become a critical safety issue with the 220,000 piston engine aircraft that require the high octane 100 low lead to fly safely. It was also noted that banning 100 low lead at airports that have taken federal funds is against the federal rules that those airports agreed to. Protests around some airports have already occurred, and more are expected as the public awareness of this issue increases. This month, Washington State voters, by a margin of over 19%, overwhelmingly voted to repeal the aviation gas tax increase. Although this was only an advisory vote to the legislature, it sent a clear message to Olympia that voters do not want to see another increase and a fuel tax that does not go toward the entity that is being taxed. The 7 cents per gallon increase would not have been designated for aviation-related programs, but would instead have gone into the state's general fund. This was part of State Senate Bill 5974, which had the purpose of addressing transportation resources in the state, but opponents pointed out that it fell far short of its stated goal, with such measures allowing anyone under the age of 18 to ride the ferry system for free, Again, its opponents have pointed out that this would reduce transportation resources, not increase or maintain them. Since this is only an advisory to the legislator, aircraft operators should not expect any decrease in the fuel tax that was signed by the governor and went into effect last July. Hey, don't forget about our Chapter Christmas holiday party on Sunday, December 11th at 5:30 p.m. The chapter will provide the main dish for the potluck, and members are encouraged to bring something to share. Well, that wraps it up for this month's podcast. Spread the word about EA Chapter 84 and the EA Chapter 84 podcast to your friends. It's available for download on most popular apps, including Spotify, Apple, and Google. Make sure to hit that like button, subscribe, and most of all, give us a 5-star review. I hope you remember to file a flight plan for next month's podcast. Be sure to find that latest news by following EA Chapter 84 on social media apps like Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Until next time, this has been your host, David Weber, and remember, stay off the brakes, keep moving forward.